walk, please.
Yes.
Okay, so number one, Kylen?
Yes, I have two questions. The first one is, what about dimension 5 operators? Because you went straight to 6.
Right. So the only dimension 5 operators, as was pointed out by Steve Weinberg, are operators that give masses to neutrinos. So I'm not sure exactly what Concha discussed in her lectures, but if neutrinos are a mile, there could be a coupling between the known left-handed neutrinos and singlet right-handed neutrinos, Yukawa coupling. So then you can write down a diagram. I guess we can't write down the diagram here. Where you have... okay. Okay, thank you. So you can write down the diagram where you... Which one? This one? That one works.
Yeah.
Where you have a left-handed neutrino, another left-handed neutrino, and something which is often called a right-handed neutrino, but really a singlet neutrino. And these can couple through a Yukawa coupling to the Higgs. So if the right-handed neutrino is heavy, this generates a dimension 5 interaction with two neutrino fields and two Higgs fields. Then if you give a vacuum expectation value to the Higgs, then you get basically a second order mass term for the light neutrino. And that's basically the only dimension 5 interaction that you can write down. But it could be playing an extremely important role in the phenomenology of neutrinos. But it doesn't play an important role, as far as I'm aware, in collider phenomenology.
And I have another question.
Yeah, there was one just behind there.
Okay.
I have a historical remark. In the year 1972, Weinberg was writing a letter to the collaboration and encouraged us to look for the single electron in the final state. And in December, 6th of December, this event was indeed found. We were very lucky, and it is now one of the textbooks events.
Right. So thank you for that remark. I would also comment that some of the veteran CERN theorists, I think, also played an important role in interacting with Gargamel and convincing them to look for neutral current events. And I'm thinking particularly of Jacques Prenky and Bruno Zamino. Well, unfortunately, neither of us still with us, but I'd like to remember them also.
There was another event. There was a conference, 1977, in honor of B.W. Lee. And it so happened that at that time we had the first results from the exposure to propane. And we succeeded to measure the delta resonance for the very first time excited by neutral currents. He was very proud of, very excited about that in his final talk.
Okay.
Yes,
Hi, this is Daniel Kincses from Hungary. So my question is, as far as I know, these W measurements use different things as inputs, such as the Z mass, I think. And then is it possible that the cause of the discrepancy is not even with the W, but, for example, with the Z?
So that I don't think is the case. Of course, so there's all sorts of uncertainties that go into the quoted error for the W mass. If you look down, there's a table in the CDF paper of the important uncertainties. So one of them is parton distribution functions. That's actually the largest uncertainty that they mention. There are people who believe that uncertainty is underestimated because They do it by basically sampling various different candidate parton distributions, but they didn't use a very complete selection. Another important uncertainty is the accuracy of the momentum measurement. That's something which I can't really say very much about. But I know there are people who have expressed concerns about the uncertainty which they assign in their paper. In particular, there was a blog post by Tommaso Dorigo who discusses that. Then the next uncertainty is the modeling of W and Z production. And there's been a fair amount of comment that CDF use a very old model for modeling the W and Z production. So there's a code called Resbos. They use a first version of Resbos. There's subsequently been a second version of Resbos, which is more sophisticated, includes more QCD corrections. There are even more QCD calculations that have been done subsequent to Resbos 2. So that's another thing that people are somewhat concerned about.
All right. Next question. Yes, Ilan.
Yeah, I was also wondering if you can consider operators, higher dimensional operators, that do not come from integrating out heavier degrees of freedom, just like it happens in gravity, for instance?
Well, of course, you could have a debate about whether those higher dimensional interactions could also be generated by, you know, exchanges of Planck mass particles. But yes, indeed, if you have particles of a higher spin, their interactions necessarily have dimensional coefficients. But I don't think that they play a role in current-day collider physics. One thing that you can think about is whether the current experiments have any sensitivity to operators of dimension bigger than 6. You asked previously about 5. I discussed in my lecture 6. And there's various windows that LHC and other experiments have on dimension 8 interactions, which I confess is one of my own personal interests. Like, for example, light-by-light scattering, which has been observed for the first time at the LHC, that is directly sensitive to dimension 8 interactions that could be present, for example, in a nonlinear Born-Infeld extension of QED, or the standard model.
Dürer?
Yeah, hi, this is Christian Dürer from Heidelberg. You mentioned it, I think, in your talk, but it was maybe a bit fast for me. So can you maybe say again how you can distinguish this, the interactions of the how you can distinguish the operators in the end? How you can distinguish if you see something from which operator it originates? They probably, I mean, you showed this plot, I think, and if I understood it correctly, there are degeneracies in this.
Yes, indeed. So I can't give a complete answer to your question, but let's just look at this slide here, which indicates the sort of thing that you can do.
Yeah, can you turn it to?
Oh. Yeah, thanks. So I mentioned that there are three operators that could be generated by single field extensions of the standard model, namely these three here. And the single field extensions which could actually generate them are these two here and these three down here. Now, here I outline how they can contribute to the W mass. Okay. But you can see that these single field extensions also contribute to other operators which have other signatures. So in principle, if you were convinced that the W mass discrepancy was due to some sort of dimension 6 operator, you could devise a sort of diagnostic program exploiting these other dependencies to try to figure out which one.
Thank you.
Yes. Anybody else? Yes.
I'm Gábor Balassa. Maybe I have a question about technical, or is it something people do nowadays?
So, the answer is that I don't think that theorists do it very much at the moment for various reasons. One of the reasons is that, okay, some sort of simple technicolor scenario, you know, could in principle work for giving masses to the W and the Z, but it's very difficult to understand, unless you make very complicated models, how to give masses to the fundamental fermions. So that was one of the reasons why, you know, many theorists sort of kind of cooled off on the technicolor concept. But one idea which, and there was another issue which I've actually highlighted on this slide, was that the original versions of technicolor tended to predict, you know, the existence of a Higgs-like particle, but which would, however, be strongly interacting and very heavy. It was disfavored by the precision electroweak data even before the Higgs was discovered at 125. So when the Higgs was discovered at 125, people said, aha, maybe that is a pseudo-Goldstone boson. And the whole phenomenology was built up, which unfortunately I didn't have time to go into, describing how in such a scenario you might get a modification of the Higgs couplings to other particles. Now, as you saw on one of the earlier plots, there's no indication of any deviation from the standard Higgs model prediction. But one of the things that experimentalists do is they look at possible coupling modifiers, which could be in principle different for each of these standard model particles, and then they give you constraints on those coupling modifiers, which might arise in sort of composite Higgs models of the type where you have a pseudo-Nambu-Goldstone boson generated by some form of technicolor. And I'm not sure what, I wasn't here when Marina Kobal gave her lectures, but it may well be that she mentioned that if you go back and look at her slides.
Thank you.
Yes. No, John, to know, because you mentioned this naturalness problem, you know, concerning the X, and then you mentioned also the proposal of Weinberg for the cosmological constant. I was wondering, just your... your opinion, your feeling, say, about naturalness, because, you know, this has been a debate for decennials, and you said that you don't want to touch SUSY or compositeness in detail of the Higgs boson, and this is fine, but just your feeling, is it in your view still to be considered a kind of problem, or do you think that now our view should be different? I speak in particular of the naturalness for the Higgs boson mass, so if you want the electroweak scale.
Yeah, well, for me it's still a problem, okay. But, you know, as a scientist, no, there are sub-problems where you think you can make progress, and there are other problems that you know are problems, but you set them on one side because at the moment, you know, it doesn't seem how you're going to be able to make progress on that. And that's somehow where I've parked naturalness for the time being. There's many other things that I enjoy thinking about at the moment where I think one can make some progress, and so that's what I'm, you know, personally focusing on. Now, a general comment is that, let's take the example of the cosmological constant. So Weinberg wrote this extremely influential paper where he gave basically an anthropic argument why the cosmological constant might have the value that it does. I don't like anthropic arguments. Now, there's various different strengths of anthropic arguments, and this is probably not the time and place to go into great detail of, you know, specific critiques of specific levels of the anthropic principle. But you know, my general worry about such arguments is that I think they tend to be anti-scientific, or at least unscientific. And so let me just give you an example. So the baryon asymmetry in the universe. So before 1967, basically your only option was to say, well, no, when God, or whoever replaces God, pushed a button on the start of the universe, he, she, or it pushed a button with a certain asymmetry between the baryon and antibaryon numbers. Okay. And anthropic arguments would then tell you how big that asymmetry would have to be. Now, we know following Sakharov that it's possible, at least in principle, to relate it to microphysics. We don't have a full detailed theory of that, but for example, neutrinos and CP violation in the neutrino sector might have played a key role in that. So I think we have the possibility of arriving at a scientific argument, verifiable by experiment, for where that asymmetry comes from. And I much prefer that approach to an anthropic argument. I mean, sometimes, of course, we don't have a non-anthropic argument, but if we can find one, I think it's infinitely to be preferred. So in this, if we're talking specifically about the cosmological constant, I mean, the problem is not the cosmological constant is there, right? Because any theory you write down basically predicts that there's some energy density in the vacuum. The problem is, why is it so small? Okay. So, you know, it could be that much maligned supersymmetry plays a role, because that would certainly cancel out, for example, the quartic divergence in quantum corrections to the cosmological constant. But I don't know how to make progress along those lines. So that's a characteristic example of the sort of problem that I've sort of parked on one side.
I'm sorry if this was already discussed, but with the CDFW mass measurement, there's some tension with the measurements at the NHC, and I wonder whether the EFT interpretation, like the fit results, play a bit of a role in there's like a mass running or so that contributes a bit. I guess not, right?
No. So in principle, the LHC experiments and CDF are measuring the exact same thing. And you know, to the extent that there is tension between the LHC measurements and the CDF measurement, that's an experimental problem. It's not a theoretical issue. Now perhaps I should have said, one of the reasons why CDF is able to hope to get a more precise measurement of the W mass is that events at the LHC are more complicated. You know, there's more crap being produced that you have to somehow sort out in order to make your W mass measurement. And another problem is that the high luminosity of the LHC means that you have many collisions taking place at the same beam crossing. And so you have to try to figure out some way of distinguishing them if you can. And so that's one of the reasons why the LHC experiments have not come up with a very precise measurement of MW so far. But of course it's tough, right? It took the CDF collaboration 10 years after they stopped taking data to come up with a measurement. But there are some ideas about how that could be measured at the LHC, possibly with comparable uncertainties to CDF, using more information about the event, possibly running the high luminosity LHC, but at low luminosity, with low pileup, which would give you more favorable conditions. So on a year or two, we may hear something more from the NHC.
Yes, or well.
So I was just wanting to ask about the dimension six effective operator that helped to correct the W boson mass. So would they affect other electroweak precision observables, or what kind of other signature they could provide to us?
Yes, they would. Let's see. Which way? So, maybe I just go down a bit further. Okay, so these are the four operators that could contribute to the W mass. Right? But as you can see on the slide, they could contribute to a whole bunch of other measurements as well, including in particular electroweak precision observables. So in thinking about the electroweak precision observables at LEP, people often talk about the so-called oblique quantities, S and T, and indeed, some of these operators do contribute to S and T, okay? And here you can see explicitly how they do it. So CHD, that appears up there, CHWB, that appears over there. CHD is one that can be generated by a single field extension of the standard model. CHWB, no, actually that's the one that cannot be generated by a single field extension. So that would be particularly interesting if you found that one was non-zero. Does that answer your question?
No, so for the constraints in the coefficient that would explain the mass, with that values, would we see like already another effect in this data from these other parameters, or it's not significant enough? So can we compare, use other?
So in principle, you could, but in this analysis that we did, that was taken into account. So here I've highlighted in red, if you do a fit, global fit to all the available data, including electroweak precision observables, you allow to have a non-zero value for these operator coefficients. If you didn't worry about those other observables, you could maybe get a slightly larger value, which might enable you to get closer to the CDF measurement. But all this effect is taken into account in our global analysis.
Thanks.
Questions? No questions? If not, let us speak. Let us thank. So we continue with the discussion.